to go around. And it's really, for us, a celebration of a lot of all the good work that we see going on everywhere where we're passing through. It's a celebration of the great independent media that you have here in Chicago and elsewhere, all the stations that air Democracy Now!, which were headlines before, and I would miss you if I know there are at least four TV and radio that are broadcasting here. Also, independent bookstores. Here we're working with Women and Children First, and it's really a pleasure to work to do all that we can to preserve these vital resources, these sanctuaries of dissent within our communities, places that preserve the diversity of voices and not just a few blockbuster voices that we see all too often in the chains. And the other thing we're celebrating is that it is the 10th birthday of a show called Democracy Now! This year. We launched this tour a week ago Monday on 9/11, a few blocks from Ground Zero in New York City. And we debated this a bit, first we thought, well, we just avoid that whole 9/11 thing, and we'll do it on the 10th, but we'll do it on the 12th. But the more we thought about it, the more we felt it was essential that we were to reclaim September 11th for the voices of peace and justice and reconciliation both here and abroad. The first tragedy occurred on that day when those planes were hijacked, but another tragedy occurred with the hijacking of that tragedy to justify illegal wars, trampling on and so we decided to bring some of the voices who have been iced out of the corporate media and put them back to center stage. We do it in our book, Static, but we also wanted to do it that night. We also had some great musicians, Charlie Hayden and his Liberation Music Orchestra joining us, and Robert Williams, a great folk singer. But one of the individuals who came was a man by the name of David McCordy. David lost his brother 5 years ago in the World Trade Center. And when David came home to tell his mother that her son would not be coming home, after the initial shock of learning that, she said to him, "I don't want any other mother or any other family anywhere in the world to feel the anguish that you're feeling right now in this family. Not in our name should this tragedy be used to cause even more death and suffering by our government or any government." You didn't hear a lot of David Cordy's voice or his mother's voice these last 5 years. He didn't fit the mold of the kind of people who were being quoted by the corporate media. The father who was asking to have his son's name written on a bomb that was to be dropped on Baghdad. The family calling for revenge on some village in Afghanistan. Those are the people who got center stage. But they weren't, in fact, the center stage. For me, some of those memorable images in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 were of the flowers placed in front of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, and of the photos tacked to the gate in front of the embassy in Sudan, and in places like North Korea and elsewhere. The solidarity, the love, and the sense that we should have a peaceful response to this. That violence, the end of violence, is not more violence. It's peace. Those are the images that were at center stage. But they got shoved aside, despite the fact that the majority of Americans were opposed to going to war in Iraq. And you didn't hear much about that either. The debate in this country, if you can call it a debate, was whatever the range of opinion was between Democrats and Republicans. CBS, ABC, NBC, The New York Times, Fox News, and everyone else. Well, 5 years later, the corporate media has been humbled, if not shamed, by its track record these last 5 years. They did a little wrong. As we knew then, and we know now, they got it completely wrong. And when people said, well, you know, the media was tricked, it was duped at bad information, that also gets it wrong. The corporate media in this country has been an essential and enthusiastic partner in disseminating the propaganda of this government.
Mind you, this is the regime of George W. Bush we're talking about.
the folks who assured us that torture was evil, that the preemptive war was evil, and that holding prisoners incommunicado in all sorts of law was evil. But the editor of the Times is not just taking the government's word when it says something is evil. Well, maybe it's this state of affairs that explains sort of what we've encountered as we've run around the country on the store and when we toured with our last book, The Exception to the Rulers, where we're finding in some of the most conservative places and some of the most rural towns, we get the largest audiences. We show up in Salt Lake City, and it's not season. So I'm thinking, why are we here? And maybe there will be many people, and I'll be related to all of them in the audience. And we show up at all, the University of Utah. It's the 700 seat hall. We're there a half hour early. Every seat is full. 300 people are lined up outside the door. And the fire marshal is there. And I then discovered another town that my sister is negotiating fire marshals. I thought she was pretty good negotiating her views with my mother in high school. So she gave this to let everybody go up on stage. And that's just Utah. So I'm guessing it may also have something to do. I think what we're seeing is the hunger for unembedded, independent information. People don't even know what they don't know, but they know they are not getting the full story from the order. Morning. We heard Monica Arar interviewed by Amy. is at JFK Airport in New York. His wife and kids would soon follow. He would not make it home to Ottawa for over a year. At JFK, he was pulled over and detained by the FBI and New York City Police. After 2 weeks in the New York immigration facility, he was shackled and put aboard a Wall Street jet in New Jersey, despite his pleas and protests that he would be tortured in Syria. He wept during the entire flight. His family didn't even know where he was being taken. In Syria, he was put in a cell the size of a grave, and he was tortured repeatedly and brutally. 374 days after he landed at JFK, Mahbubar was released from the Syrian prison. Charges were never filed against him. Days after Mahbubar's release, President Bush gave a speech in Washington criticizing Syria. Quote, dictators in Iraq and Syria have left a legacy of torture, oppression, misery, and ruin, he declared. Thanks to the United States, Mahbubar knew this history firsthand. He had been kidnapped and tortured at the behest of the most powerful nation in the world. And he was not alone. The United States is an outlaw nation. The laws that used to govern the behavior of American leaders evolved from basic codes of conduct for civilized nations. In the year 1215, Magna Carta asserted that no one, not even a king, was above the rule of law, and it established the concept of habeas corpus, a prisoner's right to challenge his or her detention in a public court of law. Kidnapping, murder, and rape, all nations agree, are crimes. The Four Geneva Conventions, the first of which was adopted in 1864, established that even in wars, civilians and combatants have rights. The conventions prohibited murder, torture, hostage taking, and extrajudicial sentencing and executions. These have long been publicly proclaimed ideals of Western nations. In private, they have been routinely violated. From the Native American conquest to slavery to Vietnam, or torture and extrajudicial killings to the Staples, the CIA's Phoenix program, to Latin America, where U.S. crack death squads rained terror on civilians throughout the 1970s and 80s, the U.S. Army School of Americas was counseled among its graduates a who's who of Latin American dictators and human rights abusers. The U.S. has been secretly involved in the torture business for years. Yet even by these sort of standards, the United States is now probing new lows. In the outlaw nation that has risen up where the U.S. once stood, holding humans in offshore cages and denying repair trials is fine. Kidnapping has become an essential tool of foreign policy. The Vice President personally lobbies the Senate to legalize torture, while the Secretary of Defense decides which medieval torments are acceptable. Drowning and freezing our in, disavowing the out. The Secretary of State props around the globe to forcefully and unequivocally reassure Swedish allies on whose soil the kidnappings and torture occur, and what they know is happening and secretly assisted is not really happening. The U.S. media speaks politely about possible abuse and refers delicately to things like stress positions. Torturing its enemies in secret is not usually with the United States. But the open, even proud embrace of it is unprecedented. Let us take a look into the dark alleys behind the iron bars and into dungeons to shed some light on the secret actions of the outlaw nation. Yesterday, Amy was interviewed by a reporter, and she raised the issue of coverage of torture or lack of it in the corporate intervention case, Mahbubar or any reporter. Look at Chicago. This is a place where the problems of inner city education, where the chair or the head of the schools decided that the solution to these problems was the military, while education would be funded everywhere else. And John was happy today for the unicorns books here in Chicago. So you hold a distinctive place in American education. The story I wrote about it, recruiting class 2005, here in Love Jones, but we continue looking at that in our book here, in a section called Students in the Crosshairs. As recruiters go on the field, we quote that the Pentagon is busy creating a high-tech database to reach out and stand around suspecting students. First, there was the obscure provision that no child left behind act that forced high schools to turn over the names and contact details of all juniors and seniors, effectively transforming President George Bush's signature education bill into the most aggressive military recruitment tool since the draft. Then, in July 2005, privacy advocates were shocked to learn that for 2 years, the Pentagon had been amassing a database of information on some 30 million students. The information dossiers on millions of young Americans where they helped identify college and high school students as only 16 to target them for military recruiting. The massive database includes an array of personal information, including birthdays, social security numbers, email addresses, where they went out to visit ethnicities and what subjects the students are studying. The Pentagon is hired in Massachusetts based on the BNL to run the database. By turning private firms to do this work, the government is circumventing laws that restrict its right to collect and hold citizen information. The Pentagon's Joint Advertising Marketing Research and Studies Group, known as JAMRS, oversees this massive data mining project. The Pentagon is spending $243 billion on JAMRS collecting data from commercial data brokers, state drivers, license records, and other sources. The JAMRS website describes the consolidated database located in BNL as arguably the largest repository of 16 to 25-year-old new data in the country, containing roughly 30 million records. If you're concerned about the information that it might be used by other agencies, well, you should be. The Pentagon has stated that it can share the data with law enforcement, state tax authorities, and other agencies making employment inquiries and foreign authorities, among others. Students will not know if their information isn't collected, and they cannot prevent it from happening. The main obstacle to getting kids into the military, concerning parents, has a long class that is circumvented. Private companies can now harvest data on children and provide private recruiters with the information they need to contact kids directly. One JAMRS study focused exclusively on how to change mothers' attitudes. In March 2004, 271 mothers from Atlanta, Chicago, Los Angeles, Denver, Dallas, New York City were interviewed in order to enable recruiters to, quote, better understand ways to motivate mothers currently on the fence to be accepting of military service and exert some influence on mothers who are currently against military service. So now, what do these teens have a new ally to challenge their overprotective mothers? The Pentagon. And in case of progressive relief, you expect a recruit to drop out of school, has a criminal record, or a single parent, each normally barred for acceptance into the military. JAMRS calls up setting moral character waiver policies to help recruiters sign up anyway. Does any Stephen Green mean anything to anyone here? Stephen Green is a soldier who was accused of brutally raping and murdering a 14-year-old girl and her family in Iraq. He was the recipient of one of these moral character waivers. So this is what we're talking about. An negative influencer said we are paying millions for the Pentagon to find their way around. That's the new term for mothers. So these are some of the things we chronicle here. Another of the stories that go into here, but when you get when you write a book, you get to check out things you've heard a little bit about, but don't really know the details. And for us, one of those stories was about the CIA's role in the newsroom. And as we got into this, it's an amazing story. It's outgrowth of this program. And that chapter is called The Running Wurlitzer. We need a different kind of media in this country. We write at the end of our introduction, it's a sad day when the government no longer has to cover up its dishonesty because the American media has supported them. This is the state of corporate media today. It's a symptom of what we call the access of evil. Journalists trade truth for access. The public unwittingly saves the illusion of news to reality. This also applies to the one-sided debates that are raised on networks and cable news. Viewers don't know what they don't know. A study of a fair and anonymous Iraq war gives you an idea of what we're talking about here. And in 2 weeks, surrounding all the powers in this 2003 speech to the UN, which made the case for the invasion, it was over 6 weeks later. 393 so-called experts appear on the major nightly network news shows. Of these, three, less than 1%, were leaders of anti-war organizations. So if you were watching the news at a time and happened to go to the bathroom, you just as the only person who might have thought like you did about the war. We can't even call this a mainstream media. It is extreme media, a media that cheerleads for war. Instead of learning from the media what is actually going on in the world, we get static, a veil of distortion, lies, omissions, and half-truths that obscure reality. As the bodies pile up in Iraq and New Orleans, many people are mystified, wondering where it went so wrong. We need a media that creates static of another kind, what the dictionary defines as criticism, opposition, or unwanted interference. Instead of a media that covers war power, we need a media that covers movements that create static and make history. Now, with lies streaming online, we need a media that cuts through the lies of paper and obscures the truth. A media that is spiritually independent, unembedded. Journalism that works to inform, not to deceive. The soldiers and civilians in harm's way in Iraq deserve no less. The citizens of the devastated Iran and Gulf Coast are counting on it. And the people shackled in America's secret gulags cry out for it. Free speech.